Last week we talked about Hamilton, which reached the kind of success we haven't seen from a musical in a long time. But there were other musicals in the 2016 season as well, and many of them were cut unusually short. One of these ill-fated shows is Tuck Everlasting, a family musical based on the popular children's book of the same name. The story of the accidentally immortal Tuck family and their relationship with an optimistic child may have only been on a Broadway stage briefly, but is still beloved by some, including my guest today, Rachel Foster. She's a friend of mine and the music director of our show choir. Also, this episode follows the custom of incomparable shows, so all spoilers will be after you hear the spoiler horn. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Tuck Everlasting. Today I'm here with my friend Rachel.
Hello!
She is in my show choir with me. She's actually one of the music directors, so she's got some good experience with working both in and outside of theater and show choir and just musicals in general. And today we're going to be talking about
Tuck Everlasting, the musical.
Yeah, also probably some about the book.
Also the book.
But so I know you have a really good story about your experience with this musical. So I think for our introduction, you should just tell this story.
Okay, so from the moment I heard that Tuck Everlasting was coming to Broadway, I was like absolutely beyond excited, like more excited than I've been for any musical ever. Because I remembered reading it when I was about 10 years old and it being kind of one of the most influential books of my childhood, and seeing it as just a really colorful stage musical was just kind of more than I could bear emotionally. So I immediately bought tickets with my friend, and I was just kind of sitting around waiting for the day when I could see it. And then one day I log on to Facebook and one of the first news stories from Playbill is that Tuck Everlasting's run is ending early and it only has 1 week left. And I was supposed to see it a month from that point. So I panicked, run online, immediately bought like two more tickets, frantically texted everyone in our show choir asking if anyone wanted to go with me. Finally got together two friends who were willing. And so at the end of that week, we all met in New York and we got to see the second last performance of the show, and it was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I am so impressed by your dedication to seeing this show. And because I remember when this happened, and because I was in Maine at the time, and you're like, does anyone want to go to New York with me to see this musical? And I was like, seems fun, but I am very far away.
The other two were in Boston, so we just met in the middle in New York.
Yeah, that worked super well.
It was amazing.
So my experience with the show, I didn't know anything about it until you shared these messages and wanted people to go with you. And I remember you were like, this show is so important to me, and because this book was so important to me, and I just really want to see this before it goes off Broadway and all this stuff. And I was like, I didn't know this was a musical at all. But I did read the book when I was in elementary school. Like, mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty standard like book to read when you're a kid.
Yeah, it's very American.
Yeah,
kind of like kid story.
Yeah. And I kind of remembered it, and then they made a movie that starred Rory Gilmore, who has a real name, but the person who played Rory Gilmore. Yeah. And I think I saw that movie too, but I'd forgotten about it. Mm. But now this musical exists, and I listened to the soundtrack with you and read a bit about the plot, so now I have a general idea of what it was.
Yeah,
even though I didn't get to see it. So before we get into anything that's spoilery or talk about like big plot points, what are your overall feelings about this musical?
My overall,
besides that you just adore it.
Besides that I love it with all of my soul. My overall feelings were, I think, kind of what it was, line up really well with what it was billed as, which is that it's an amazing show both for kids and for adults, which I truly felt about the book as well. And I feel that kind of just the addition of music and like visual, like set and costumes to the experience of reading the book, like really, it just enriches the story. There are times where you like see musicals made out of movies or books and it kind of feels like it didn't have to be a musical, but this one really felt like it worked like so well as a musical, and that anyone could see it and learn something from it and really enjoy it.
You know, I can kind of see that, because even though I'm much less familiar with both versions of this than you, I can also kind of sense when I listen to the music the way that this is like a very emotional story, and mm-hmm. it's a very I would even say vibrant, and I can imagine the way that like staging can really help those emotions translate to the audience.
Yeah, it also, it's kind of the sort of thing where you know when you rewatch Disney movies when you're an adult, and suddenly everything Like, you see more layers of meaning and emotion in it. It's almost like that, except even as a kid reading this book, like, I already got so much out of it. And I just think that that translates to the stage so well. Because it becomes a family show where everyone can see it and no one gets bored.
Mm-hmm. So the basic premise of this story is that there is a... It's Tuck Everlasting because there's a family called the Tucks. And they are immortal. And then there's a little girl, Winnie Foster, who's 11 years old, who discovers them and discovers their secret.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like the story from there. But that's the basic premise of it. I feel like it's one of the first stories that a lot of kids like in the U.S. grapple with this idea of immortality with.
Absolutely.
Because it's kind of the first story that tells you like, oh, immortality might be not be as cool as you think it is.
Absolutely. I have very, very clear memories of discussing in like fifth grade. We read this book and my teacher just said, so like, who would want to live forever? And this one boy raised his hand and was like, yeah, I think that'd be the coolest thing ever. And the rest of our class was kind of sitting there like, we're not so sure anymore, thanks to this book.
Yeah. This is a slight digression, but this was a conversation I was having with some friends recently. Like, honestly, there's a part of me that's like really down for
really?
Immortality. Yeah.
I am so against it. I think every time I think about immortality, I think about Tuck Everlasting, but I am so not down for living forever.
See, I think, I don't know. It's again, this is not the point, but it's an interesting thought experiment. And I know I can see the issues with it.
Mm.
And I don't, maybe if I could guarantee to live for like 500 years, yeah. I don't know. But maybe not forever, but like definitely significantly longer than the human lifespan.
Yeah, I'd be down for more time, but still finite time.
Yeah. Well, that's another podcast, I'm sure. But back to the show. The characters in the show did not have a choice about this, the Tucks.
No, so there's a spring in the woods next to Winnie Foster's house, and about 100 or so years earlier, the Tuck family, which is May and Angus, the parents, and then Miles and Jesse are the sons, they stumble across the stream and they drink from it, and from that point on, they are immortal, and anytime they get injured, they don't die.
Yeah, that's pretty good immortality, because some versions you can still be killed,
mm-hmm.
but they're like pretty set on everything.
Yeah, they're pretty permanently immortal.
I mean, you know, there are varying levels of immortality in fiction.
Right. Another thing I like about it is it's one of those stories where it's a realistic setting. It's like real world, and then you change one thing, and it kind of explores what happens if you change that like one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like very real, late 1800s, like 1893 America. But this one stream that's made a couple people immortal and kind of like see how the world deals with that.
Yeah. And it's also a very personal character driven story as mm-hmm. well. Like, it's not like big world ramifications. It's really like the story of this family and this girl yeah. and the interactions between them. Which I think is part of what helps it translate well to a musical because
yeah, absolutely.
Like most good musicals are really focused on characters. I mm-hmm. feel like.
Absolutely. It's a small town America kind of story. And yeah, everyone, especially actually, I think in the musical, you see much more of what the family is thinking. I think in the book, you definitely are mostly in Winnie's head and you still get that in the musical, but I think you hear much more from the other characters and about their lives. So I really appreciated that as well.
So tell me about the music in this show.
The music in this show it's a very particular style. You described it as sounding Irish, which I think is really funny.
So we're currently in Ireland.
We're currently in Ireland.
Just for fun.
So maybe just Ireland's on the brain.
Yeah, so I listened to this in Ireland and I was like, wow, this sounds so Gaelic.
Yeah.
But it's not actually.
So there's just lots of, it's very bouncy is the first word that I think of to describe it. But there's lots of like fiddle, acoustic guitar, some sort of stringed thing going on that I think might be a dulcimer. But it's just it's very Americana. I know I keep saying that, but it's kind of just like a quintessentially like late 1800s American kind of sound, which I think is very, very cool. And I think the composers did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm. It is, for a lot of it sounds like very bright. There's a lot of fiddles. Yeah. I'm a fan of fiddles.
I love fiddles.
Let's talk about some of the people that were in this show.
Oh my gosh. So first and foremost, for me at least, is Andrew Keenan-Bolger, who played... Crutchy in the original Broadway cast of Newsies. So this was my second time seeing him on Broadway. And as usual, he is incredible. I think he's pretty old now, but he forever looks like a child.
By old, you mean like 25 or something?
I think he might be like 30, but he plays a 17-year-old extremely convincingly.
Okay.
Which I think is also kind of funny because, you know, who knows, maybe Andrew Keenan Bulger's immortal. But,
plot twist.
Plot twist. So he's absolutely incredible as Jesse Tuck, the very hopeful 17-year-old. And then also Carolee Carmello, who she plays May Tuck. I had no idea who she was before this. But she and Michael Park, who played her husband and is now in Dear Evan Hansen as one of the fathers.
There's only one father in the show.
As the one father. both of them have had like really long, incredible careers in musical theater. And I'm really glad that Tucker Fasting introduced me to them. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then the girl who plays Winnie Foster, Sarah Charles Wallace, she's literally 11. She's the same age as her character. And
that's really impressive.
I know. And from all of the YouTube interviews that I've seen, like absolutely like was incredible and extremely mature in her role and really understood kind of the story that she was telling. So that's pretty amazing.
Can I just say, Broadway babies are my Broadway favorites. Babies. I got to see School of Rock, which by the way, is one of those shows that consistently has $40 rush tickets at the door. Anyway, that's how I got to see it. And there are so many Broadway babies in that show. They're so little.
Oh my gosh.
Broadway babies is anyone under 15.
Anyone under 15.
Basically.
Yeah.
But yeah. Also, Terrence Mann.
Oh, yes.
Not a Broadway baby. Person not in Tucker Everlasting.
Not a Broadway baby. He plays the villain, mm-hmm. only known as the man in the yellow suit, which is an excellent name for a villain. And yeah, I had seen him in Sense8 before seeing Tucker Everlasting. And he came on stage and I was like, oh my goodness, it's the other evil guy. Apparently he's just very good at playing very terrifying old men.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting typecast.
Interesting typecast.
Yeah, so it's a pretty solid cast overall.
Oh, it was a very solid cast, which made it so much more, like, it was very set up to be a Broadway hit. And unfortunately, because of timing, kind of all fell apart.
Can I say that this show, from what you've said about it and what I know about it, kind of reminds me of Finding Neverland?
Yeah.
It has a lot of the same feeling just when I think about it.
It's like a very imaginative and meaningful show.
Yeah.
It's very colorful.
Finding Neverland is another Broadway show that I got to see, and it's about the story of how Peter Pan was written.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much like it's geared towards kids and families, but it's still like enjoyable by adults, and kind of whimsical and like upbeat music and all that kind of stuff. And it seems like it's in the same mm-hmm. family of show.
Yeah. I love that family of show. Some people might call it a feel-good musical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I sobbed tears of sadness during this. I was not feeling good the whole time, but it was just every second of it was incredible and just packed with meaning.
I do feel like there's kind of this pressure on Broadway right now to be super imaginative and almost gritty
mm-hmm.
and like you really want to cause your audience pain and all this kind of stuff is like, because Hamilton was revolutionary and like Dear Evan Hansen is the next big thing, and that's
mm-hmm.
a lot of
that's a whole nother,
and it's like, and all of these shows that are like not what you would think of as traditional musicals
mm-hmm.
whereas these other shows like Finding Neverland and Tuck Everlasting are just like, this is just a good solid family friendly good time.
Yeah, but on top of that just makes you I actually have a very special place in my heart for Tuck Everlasting. I really think that despite being a family friendly show, there's nothing wrong with family friendly shows and I adore them to the end of the earth, but this one in particular, I think you leave the theater thinking and rethinking what you believe about like life and how it's meant to be lived and if it's meant to be lived forever, so in that way I think it's very very special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's to still talk about it being for kids, quote unquote, as well. Yeah. I do think that's super important. Like you were talking about when you read this book as a kid and it just stayed with you. And I guess my point here is like things being geared to kids don't mean that they are one dimensional. And that it is really cool to have
mm-hmm.
this media that is in fact aimed at children, but aimed at them, like taking them seriously as people who can understand deep concepts and that should learn about them young.
Absolutely. I remember Bridge to Terabithia being the first book I ever read where a main character died. And I remember that kind of hitting me like a pile of bricks. And I similarly remember reading Tuck Everlasting and just thinking like, oh my gosh, immortality used to sound great. And now I'm not so sure. And I was only 10 and I was already having those kinds of like kind of big world thoughts. And then at the same time, like when I went to see it as a musical, I kind of got, there's this one line, there's a song that Carolee Carmello, May Tuck, sings called My Most Beautiful Day, where she describes the most beautiful day of her life, which is now everlasting. And she has this one line that always hits me, and it's, looking back is something to look forward to, which I think now as I'm older and still young, obviously, but like getting closer and closer to being like a real person with real responsibilities, and kind of just getting excited to have like this part of my life and the next couple stages of my life to look back to one day, I think now it brings different and additional things to me than it did when I was a kid, and I think that's pretty incredible.
And I feel like it is something that will continue growing with you, because I mean,
absolutely,
experiencing this story when you like have grandchildren is going to be way different.
One day when I'm a parent, Time, which is already my favorite song, is going to make me sob like a baby. And yeah.
Yikes.
I'm so excited to see what I think about the show when I'm old. And when I'm, someday, if I'm like super old and like death is not that far away, like then what will the show mean to me? I'm just so excited to see how this grows. My favorite song, it's technically split into two songs, but it's called Time and then the Time Quartet. And in Time, I like to call it kind of like the thesis point of the story, which I personally think is that like immortality is not great. But it's the story of how Miles had a family, and then as when he became immortal, his family became scared of him because he wasn't aging, and eventually his family was taken away from him. And it is kind of just the lament of all the things that time has taken away, and that he has so much time and all he has is time, but he still couldn't have time with his son. And then it goes straight into the Time Quartet, where you hear all four members of the family talking about their experiences. And it strikes a very different tone, because Jesse, the youngest, is 17, didn't have a family besides the Tucks before he became immortal. And so is kind of always very excited. And he is like some people, he's so down to live forever. He loves exploring the world, kind of never feels tied down or burdened by this blessing/curse. So you kind of hear that hope, as well as the parents who are kind of just worried about their life together and the fact that they've kind of gotten stuck in their marriage and their relationship. And then you also hear from Miles, who is still mourning the loss of his wife and his son. So just as a song, it kind of ties together just all of the really complex feelings being felt by these four characters. And it's so beautiful. And it's heartbreaking. And also when you see it on stage, they make use of a ballet during it, so while the character is singing it, you see two other characters kind of dancing the story, and it just makes it like, it's so heart-wrenchingly beautiful but also so sad.
Yeah, you were talking a little bit before about how ballet is incorporated into this show, and as you mentioned before, like they use ballerinas could kind of do interpretive dance of some of the characters' stories. Like, how does that work with the music and the plot?
So ballet in the show is really frequently used to kind of show the passage of time, which I think is really, really beautiful. So for example, the biggest and I think most surprising to the audience use of it was in the second to last song. There are a couple songs in the show that are titled The Story Of and then the name of a character. And the last one to happen is The Story of Winnie Foster. So it shows in one song, depicts her entire life from the moment the Tucks leave her to the moment that she dies. And it's only 3 minutes and it's entirely instrumental. And the way that they do this is they use ballerinas who are portraying the characters of her life. And you see, it interweaves the happy and sad parts of her life. So you see her grandmother die, but then you see her fall in love with someone else in the village, and then you see her have a baby, like get married and have a baby, but then her mother dies, and then her son grows up, and then her son falls in love, and then her son leaves, and then her husband dies, and then she's the only one left, and then she dies. And just in one song, you don't get any words, but you get that entire story. And I think that when they made the decision to tell that story through dance, I think that was an absolutely brilliant decision. And even the way that they transitioned into it was incredible. The 11-year-old actress who plays Winnie for the entire show kind of, like, Shanae turns her way behind their house, and then the person who comes out on the other side is the ballerina playing her a couple years later. And from that moment on, I spent the entire rest of the show crying. And it's just, it's such a powerful ballet that just shows you, like, the passage of life and its happy moments and its sad moments just all together.
I also feel like that's a really great way to add value to the show that you can't get from the soundtrack. Because this is an interesting balance just in musicals overall. Like, shows that have, especially, like, original Broadway cast recordings, is you can get all of the music in them and a lot of the plot of them usually as well. But, like, spoilers and I feel like because of that, spoilers in musicals work differently than spoilers in films. Because the plot can be spoiled for you, like, if someone tells you about it. But, like, if you've listened to the soundtrack, that's a different thing than just, like, it being quote-unquote spoiled. Yeah. But it's still amazing when a show can add, like, distinct surprises for you as well, even beyond, like, of course you still want to go see it if you really like the soundtrack and you're like us, of course you just want to go see it and see people feel that emotion in real time and act it out for you, because that's just an experience in itself. But it's also so cool when there are hidden elements that they don't put on the cast recording just to surprise live audiences, or stuff like that where there's incredibly powerful visual elements that you wouldn't even know about if you had just listened to it, but you get to experience when you go see it on stage.
Yeah, this is a controversial opinion. I feel like if I spend the rest of my life and never once get to see Hamilton, I feel like that would be okay, because I feel like I understand the story through the entire soundtrack, since it's almost entirely a sung through show. But I feel like I couldn't get the same things that I get now out of the soundtrack to Tuck Everlasting if I hadn't seen it on stage. Because I wouldn't know what to do with the 3-minute instrumental, whereas now I can listen to it, and by the changes in music, I can tell what parts of the story are being told at that point. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's a very cool aspect of it.
Hamilton, which I'm sure is going to come up on every episode of this show, is pretty distinct in that way, because it is almost entirely sung through, which is uncommon. It's like Hamilton and Les Mis and Rent all have original Broadway cast recordings that are, like, pretty much sung through the entire show, and so you can kind of experience the whole thing. Whereas most musicals leave out parts, or even, like, the Spring Awakening cast recording is specifically very much not plot heavy. Like, there's no way to tell what's going on just by listening to that soundtrack, speaking from experience. Yeah. I mean we'll have an episode of Spring Awakening where I'll get into this, but I listened to the cast recording and I really liked a lot of the music, and then I read the Wikipedia plot summary and there's so much going on that you just have no idea.
It's insane. Spring Awakening is an experience.
Yeah, but Tuck Everlasting is definitely in the middle here, where you can kind of tell what's going on by listening to it, but you still miss out on a lot that you can get partially by reading the plot summary online, which is what I did so that I could follow along the soundtrack, but also just, you know, seeing the scenes, the spoken scenes in between songs.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing about Tuck Everlasting that I kind of think works out in a very poetic way, that it is kind of a show about, like, enjoying something while it lasts and things not being around forever, and the show itself did not last as long as people thought it would, and it wasn't around forever, but we kind of still, those of us who were lucky enough to see it when it was on Broadway, kind of still get to enjoy it even after it's gone.
So, I mean, I know this must be a painful subject for you, but do you want to talk about the fact that it did leave Broadway so quickly?
I do. Another controversial opinion. All of my controversial opinions surround Hamilton. I don't know how much truth there is in this. I think there is at least some truth to it. But I feel that as much as I absolutely adore Hamilton, as brilliant as it is, what it has done a little bit is get people what we would hope it would do would be to get people more excited about musical theater in general and get more people seeing all Broadway shows. What I think it did, at least in the initial period of time that it was open, which conflicted with Tuck Everlasting, was get people very excited about Hamilton. And then people who were coming to New York to see a Broadway show only wanted to see Hamilton. And I feel that that may have had something to do with Tuck Everlasting closing early. I know that looking through the tickets that had been booked for after the closing, there were probably, again, why they closed, there were very few seats booked for each performance. However, in the performance that I went to, absolutely every seat was taken because it was clear that there were people who wanted to see this, just not enough. And I think that might have had something to do with Hamilton, which makes me feel terrible to think about. But I truly believe that that might have been a contributing factor.
Mm-hmm. I saw this joke on Tumblr one time where it was something like the economy killed like 5, Playbill killed 21, Hamilton closed the other 51, or that's whatever so, it is.
Yeah.
I totally butchered so glad every reference I just made. But
I'm so glad I'm not the only one with that opinion, but I do, there were a surprising number of early Broadway closings right around mm-hmm. when Hamilton was happening, and yeah. Tuck Everlasting was a casualty of that.
Yeah. Just for people who haven't listened to Hamilton, those are lines from Hamilton that are adapted to talk about all of the shows that closed on Broadway this year, because it is truly so many yeah. shows from this year's season ended up closing very early. Mm-hmm. Cause I remember Bright Star closed. I was in New yeah. York for a weekend and Bright Star was on my list of shows. Cause I've bought tickets ahead of time for a couple of shows that I've seen on Broadway, and I've been very lucky to be able to see quite a few because I go to New York a lot. But most of the time, like, I go and I get, like, lottery seats, and I go to the TKTS, like, 50% off mm-hmm. booth and stuff. So Bright Star was on my list to try to go see, which is the Steve Martin musical. And then they were like, oh, they're closing this weekend. Like, they don't have any tickets. And I was like, what? They just...
Yeah.
They look so good at the Tonys. No.
Yeah. I mean, to close with a week's notice is huge.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's pretty upsetting.
Yeah. And I'm hoping that this is... I think that Hamilton did pull more people into musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right as well that because it's so successful. And I think it does have yeah. something to do with pushing other shows out, especially maybe even because tickets to Hamilton are so expensive
yeah.
and in a really ridiculous level. and I think that may have turned, that might also be part of what is turning people off from going to see other shows because of this perception that like Broadway is so unattainable. Right. And of course, like it is a blessing to be able to see Broadway shows, and like we're very lucky for that, but you can also, like, there are shows that have like very easily accessible, like mm-hmm. $30 tickets, $40 tickets on a daily basis. They're not all like Hamilton, where like the cheapest you could possibly get is a $200 ticket if you're super lucky. Gosh. Like this ridiculousness. And so I think that might also be part of it as well, as like this economic/psychological crowding out.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we love Hamilton, to be clear.
Oh my god, it's
incredible.
Like the fault of the show. It's an incredible right. work of art, but it's like the culture surrounding it.
Yeah, it was just an unfortunate and kind of surprising fallout.
I feel like the way that other shows have been affected by Hamilton from the perspective of people who are already into musical theater is interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's so many people, and like I think this is great. Like if you don't really, if you were not super into musical theater and like Hamilton pulled you into it, or even if you're like only kind of listening to Hamilton, not anything else, like that's still incredible. And
right.
I'm like totally am excited for everybody, but it is interesting to be someone who is already really into musical theater and like watching that happen to the rest of the world.
Yeah. And to see the entire world's perception of musical theater suddenly be just Hamilton, and to be sitting there knowing like there are so many other, Hamilton is incredible, but there are also so many other incredible stories being told.
Mm-hmm. Like Tuck Everlasting.
Like Tuck Everlasting. Just circle back around.
Yeah, let's bring this back. So someone who has experienced this in many stages of life and through many different forms of media, what do you think of the adaptation of book to musical?
Yeah, so in order to more fully assess this, and because I'm entirely nerdy, I bought a copy of the book about a week as soon as I found out that I was going to see Tuck Everlasting that week, and I read the entire book in one day and then went to see the show the next day. So I got to notice all of those small things that changed. And one of the biggest things is that the book also has kind of like a justice element to it. This is all spoilers, but in the book, Maytuck accidentally kills the man in the yellow suit by hitting him over the head with the butt of a rifle. And he dies and someone sees it and she is put in jail and she's supposed to be hanged. And Winnie Foster, who was only 11, then takes her place in jail so that she and her family can escape and kind of just run from the law in that way. And as a kid, this was another thing that we focused on a lot when we talked about the book, and we put Maytuck on trial in the classroom, and I got to be Maytuck. But that aspect is totally missing from the musical, which really surprised me, because I remember like that being a difficult thing to think about when I was a kid. Like, she killed someone, but I still believe that she's innocent. And in the musical, she hits him over the head with a shotgun and he dies. And then the police walk on stage and say, "How did this man die?" And the 11-year-old goes, "It was an accident." And that's just the end of it. And there isn't that aspect, because the show had obviously decided to focus on the questions of immortality and not on the whole other kind of plot that was there. So that was the biggest change. But I don't find myself being sad about that change. I really think that it was effective in this shorter amount of time to focus on what they focused on. The ballet, also an incredible addition, I really believe. And there's another thing as well, which I think all good musicals adapted from books do, which is that they had nods in the musical to phrasing or exact words in the book that wouldn't have otherwise translated to stage, which I really felt was in there, like, for the people who remembered reading this book. So the opening of this book is very famous, and I remember talking about it a lot as a child. And it starts out by describing the seasons of the year as a Ferris wheel, which you don't know at the time that you read it for the first time, but obviously later that becomes like a symbol of time and like cycles. And obviously, because this is kind of like a descriptive way to start a story, they couldn't really include it in the musical, but they found a way to do it by having an entire song called The Wheel, in which Angus sings to Winnie about how life is a wheel, and if it stops and you just watch life pass you by, then that's not truly living. So I just felt throughout the entire show that the creators had like the greatest respect for Natalie Babbitt's like original work and writing, and that they wanted to bring it to life as truthfully as they possibly could. And she actually, Natalie Babbitt, went to the premiere and I think absolutely loved the show. So,
that's great.
If the author loves it, then it's good enough for me.
We also have to just take one moment to acknowledge the weird problematic part of this musical.
There's only one.
As far as I know. Which is that one of the plot lines of this musical is that there's one character, Jesse, who's a mortal 17-year-old, and there's a Winnie Foster who's 11 years old, and Jesse wants Winnie to grow up 6 years until she's 17 and then drink this immortal water and then marry him.
Yes.
Explain this to me.
Okay. So the first thing that you need to know is that Jesse loves, he's the hopeful one, as I've said, he loves to travel, and they sing a song together called Partner in Crime, where they're just very excited. He hasn't had a friend in, I don't know, like 50, 70 years. Like, he hasn't had a friend in ages, and he's glad to finally have someone to like share all these experiences with. There are a couple lines in the show that nod to it being weird. So he asks her to wait, but he doesn't tell his parents that he asked her to wait, and they get kind of angry when they find out. But when he's telling her about how great his life is and how much he wants to one day like have a friend to share it with, she kind of goes, "Oh, you make this sound so exciting. I just want to drink the water now." And he's like, no, you have to wait. There's a difference. And she's like, "What is the difference?" And he goes, "Trust me, there's a difference," which made me kind of uncomfortable. But my belief, I truly believe, that getting married to Winnie for him is more about having a permanent friend, and someone who is like societally allowed to spend every second of the day with, as opposed to him seeing an 11-year-old and being like, "Man, I want to marry her in 6 years." just so it's not creepy.
Yeah, that's just so weird. Because, like...
It is really weird.
It's just so weird to think... Because, like, as a person who was 17 a couple years ago... So like,
oh, yeah.
Basically in that headspace. Like, the idea of looking at 11-year-old and be like, yeah, I'm going to marry them. That's not what happens.
Right. First of all, I think that his main proposal is just that she also be immortal at age 17 so they can be friends forever. I think getting married is kind of just like the vehicle for them to stay together forever. But also, I think what's important to remember is that this is not what happens. Like, the musical does present this as like the wrong option, and it's not what she chooses. And in the end, like after Winnie's dead, after living her whole life, in the end, Jessie is ultimately glad that she didn't wait for him and that she lived her life to the fullest and didn't let him kind of like hold her back.
Yeah, that is super important, because if the musical had, or the story at all, had been about like the fact that she does become immortal when she's 17 and then be with this guy, it would have been
very creepy. Yeah,
pretty creepy. But it's not. Like, this is presented as an option to her, and she, like, as this incredibly wise 11-year-old is like, no, and then chooses not to do that and to live her whole normal lifespan.
Yeah.
But it's... So I understand why the story does that, because they want to present this conflict of immortality and what life is, and they want her to, as a child, to be faced with that decision and to make the decision to live a full life. Yeah. And so having this presentation of, like, all you have to do is grow up and then you could have this immortal family and like this guy that you think is cute and like all this stuff. But, and have her make that choice. But it's just weird to think about it like from his perspective, especially as someone who has been alive for like 100 years or something like that.
Mm. Yeah. I think the musical deals with this in a couple of ways. Even though Jessie has been alive for like an exceedingly long amount of time, they still portray him as like kind of a 17-year-old at heart. And it doesn't seem like he has grown up in that time. I think that's a very important plot point, is that he very much still has like that optimistic outlook of a 17-year-old who gets to be like stuck with no roots forever. So in that way, I think that like they interact on stage very much as two people who are like of one mind, and not that he is 100 years old versus 11. It's very much that 17 versus 11. But also, from his shoes, like, he has been wandering the world alone for a very, very long time. And this is he has a friend, and he wants to be with this friend forever and ever. And I really don't think it's a romance thing. There's no indication in the show that it's a romance thing, besides that weird use of the suggestion that they get married. So I'm just gonna willfully believe that it's a friend thing.
Yeah, and I can see the way that this could be portrayed as like that he is just so overwhelmed with excitement to have someone in his life, because of the way he comes back at the end and is like, no, I'm very glad that she chose not to become immortal.
Right.
Which isn't also a good, like, I feel like the character is weird, but the show handles it well.
Yes.
Basically.
I believe that.
Yeah, which is a thing that, you know, works of art do, and that's okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, overall, still think it's weird and a little problematic, but...
I mostly just ignore it.
Rachel.
Yes.
Are you ready for the lightning round?
I think I'm ready for the lightning round.
Okay. Favorite song in the show?
Time.
Favorite line?
You're an evil banana.
I was not prepared for that.
I know you weren't. The old, Winnie's old grandmother says it to the man in the yellow suit, and everyone in the entire audience just died.
That's so great.
On the spot.
Favorite character in the show?
Maytuck.
Okay. Who would you recommend it to?
I think especially parents. I think it's a really interesting storyline for parents to think about and to think about their children.
If you can combine this musical with any other musical, which would you pick?
The first thing that comes to mind is Newsies, because of Andrew Keenan Bolger. Ooh. And I think that if he was the missing link and that secretly Crutchy is also immortal, I think that'd be pretty incredible. And they take place in like the same 10 years as well, so I think it's possible.
All right. I like that. That's a good choice. Okay, thanks so much for coming to talk with me.
Thank you for having me. I love talking about musicals.
It was super fun. I'm really glad I got to listen to this show.
Yay!
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Corner of the Sky. You can find us on Twitter at COTS Podcast, or find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS. You can also find us in Apple Podcasts, where it would be cool if you left us a review, at least while you still have time.
I listen to the movie soundtrack of Rent, and I know I'm not bad. I'm
a bad person. That's one I have too.
I'm gonna take that whole part out. And just do that again.
Can the cold open of the episode be us whispering about how we're bad people for having the movie version of Rent?